Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Now everyone can see that something big is happening, and the system that we know so well is slowly unraveling, and everybody everywhere stands to be affected, and the word of the day is unprecedented. It's been a really, really, really strange day. The only thing we know for sure is everything has changed. Strange day. Oh, yes, indeed. I'm gonna keep on washing them until my hands are clean.
It's all going on, Jay.
There you go. Well, at least we've both had our faff now.
Right, I'm with you. It's a table, actually. It's a new kitchen table.
Ooh, very nice.
For a new house. I've just moved to Bristol.
I saw that on your Instagram, actually. The Brizzle. Great.
I want to tell you a story to start this off. So I haven't really been here since moving, because I moved in just after Christmas, and I spent, I think, the first week it was whilst I was in Bristol, basically self-isolating, because I've just done this like monster truck arena tour. And ahead of that, I wasn't allowed to go anywhere or see anyone, because obviously if I caught COVID, I wouldn't be able to host the show.
All right. So you was isolating without having COVID, just in order to not get it.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, it was. I had to sign like a COVID clause. So I haven't been anywhere. I haven't really hung out in Bristol. And then I went and did these shows. So today was kind of my first day in Bristol, walking around, seeing the town. And I put on Survival of the Friendliest, the latest record. Mm-hmm. I listened. And then I went backwards to Knee Deep in Nostalgia and the other one you put out in 2020. Which is called
The Unforeseeable Future.
Those three records. And I've got to tell you this, man. I was walking around Bristol, and part of this as well is I've recently given up everything. So like drugs,
everything,
booze, cigarettes,
sex,
sex. Yeah. Even sex. I'm actually at the moment consciously celibate. Basically anything in my life that was leading to bad decisions and situations, which for me actually presently did include sexual relationships,
right?
Because I was only having like one night stands, you know, when drinking with, you know, problematic people, let's say.
Okay, fair.
So I'm like living the life of a monk. So also through the process of doing that, as you know, when you kind of do make that decision to come off things like nicotine especially, your body and your mind changing and transforming.
Sure.
And you begin to smell and taste and experience life almost like in HD for the first time, because the fog has cleared. So I'm walking around Bristol. I'm listening to your music. You know, it's a new year. It's a beautiful day here. I'm not sure what it's like down where you are, but the sun is shining. The sky is blue.
Nice.
It's beautiful here. And I'm listening to your three records. And I started weeping, dude. I started crying. Happy tears, good tears.
I was going to say, surely tears of joy. Well, I don't know. I guess need... Unforeseeable Future has probably got some fucking miserable songs on it, but
we'll get into that one, because the last time I had you on the show was just before all of this madness that we slipped into. It was January 2020.
Was when it was face to face, wasn't it?
It was face to face before times.
Yeah,
and we've got loads to catch up on. But I just wanted to start the chat off by telling you that I'm in a really positive place in my life, and having your music in my head as I was walking around Bristol today, because you are such a positive, beautiful storyteller, and just a really a great guy, a great human being, and somebody that I'm so privileged and you know, happy to know. And I just felt this really overwhelming sense of joy and like contentment whilst walking around Bristol. Like everything was in its right place, and you were the soundtrack to that moment. And I wanted to let you know that I appreciate you a lot, dude, as an artist and as a human being. And I think whenever we've met and hung out, you always give off, and this comes across in your music too. Anybody who listens to your stuff will know this, but you're a good guy. You're a really good guy, and the world is infinitely richer for having you in it. So I just wanted to say
that.
That's
the end of the podcast. So we've got that done.
Another one in the bank.
Upload that, motherfucker. Thank you for the kind words. I mean, the kind of mission statement for the newest album, Survivor of the Friendliest, was that, you know, and that was what my heart was saying at the time. And it was written this time last year, you know, pretty dark times, but I didn't feel like that. Like it was something about the mood that was going on. I thought a lot about it, and I put a lot of it down to having a creative output. I mean, as you know, when COVID hit, I wrote a whole album about that. I'd already written an album about climate catastrophe and the fucking Tory government and stuff like that. And when things were really dark, and I didn't want to sing about any of that. I didn't want to moan or whinge about the world. I didn't want to add anything that was going to scare everyone. I wanted to celebrate the things that were, you know, that still could be celebrated in this world we live in. And that was definitely my mindset. I found myself during that period searching out good stories, basically. Like I read a book called Humankind by a guy called Rutger Bregman, which is, you know, all about, it's called like it's like a retelling of history about why humans are actually great. We just like focus on negatives a lot. And that's where I got the title, Survivor of the Friendliest, is like straight out of that book. And it was just, I was searching things for books and sort of moments. And also I just sort of felt like, what do I want to be presenting to the world at the moment? Do I want to be standing up there and saying, fucking hell, ain't it bad? You know, like there's no hope. It's like, no, you know, like if I'm not naive to the problems that we face, but in order to fucking, you know, live up to them and be able to do anything, we need to be, I truthfully believe we need to be strong of heart and mind, you know, we need to be sort of in a good place and know what's fighting for. So that was kind of the sort of mindset of Survivor of the Friendliest. And from the whole process, it was one of the most affecting albums that I've made. And, you know, I've made a lot of records as well, but it was something about it just being solid positivity from front to back. Writing the songs made me feel great. You know, like you just singing them over, and I was like, yeah, man, things are good. You know, sort of falling for my own bullshit a little bit. And then it was like, the recording process was the same. Again, you constantly repeating the songs over and over. They turn into like a mantra. So whatever song you're recording and the people that you're recording with are obviously going to soak up whatever energy you put into that song. And this, we did a week. So I recorded it with Blaine Harrison from the Mystery Jets and Jack Flanagan. And we did a week here where I am now in this studio at the bottom of my garden, recorded and wrote a bunch of the sort of music, the songs were written. And then we went to a studio in Ramsgate called Big Jelly. And it was like, we started on solstice and it was like sunny outside. We was going swimming in the sea, watching sunsets, coming back and just singing these really positive songs. And it made everybody feel amazing. We was like finishing takes like, oh my God, like really elated by the whole thing. And straight away then I was just like, I can't wait to take this on the road and be able to step up on stage in a time when everybody's a bit beaten down by life or whatever, and just be able to stand there and be like, isn't everything fucking great? You know, I just go completely against the grain. And it has been, I mean, because we started the tour, I did like 20 dates in December. And that was, you know, I'd sort of always open the show with being like, look, I know there's a lot of shit going on, but rather than me commenting on it, should we just forget about everything? And for an hour and a half, let's just concentrate on celebrating the good things. And I kind of ditched all my sort of whingy songs out of my set list. And sort of because I just figured no one wants to hear it right now. Music has a lot of great reasons for existing, doesn't it? But one of them is certainly to be able to forget your troubles and just live in the moment for, you know, for the time of the gig. And it was, again, the tour was super powerful, like because it felt like having these songs as ammunition going so far against the grain, it was just like, yeah, it felt fucking beautiful doing it night after night, basically.
Well, you touch on a couple of things there I want to pick your brain about, because I do feel like at the moment, and this has been the way I think even before COVID, but that certainly intensified this feeling, is like everybody is so quick to see the negative, and negativity is a very overriding theme in today's society. And like, whatever aspect of life that is, there's always this kind of readiness, I think, to jump on, you know, the topic or a person or the viewpoint and see it in like a kind of a catastrophic way. And
certainly a divisive way.
Certainly a divisive way. And I think everybody is well within their rights to kind of be on edge in that sense, because there is a lot of uncertainty and unrest and division, and, you know, that there's discontent around every corner. But I feel like in this time, it's almost radical and revolutionary to be somebody who's just standing out there and saying, like, let's be positive. And positivity for me feels very against the grain at the moment, like it does. And so someone like you, I think that's why it really overwhelmed me today, is I just, you know, and there's other artists doing it. You're not like isolated on this island of joy, and it's only you.
Yeah.
But
I'm so happy.
There's certainly like less and less of them. And, you know, and obviously art should always tackle and challenge, as you have always done as well, you know, and it should highlight the, you know, the flaws in every element of society and, you know,
sure. And
where we're at. And you, as you say, you're a realist. You don't bury your head in the sand. You're not naive. You're informed. But I found it so empowering and hopeful to hear somebody kind of just be like, no, actually, there's a lot to be worried about, of course, and there's a lot going on that is bad, but life can be beautiful. It's all kind of, and this is very hippie-ish, and I've only been in Bristol a week, and it's the vibe here is already infecting me.
Yeah.
But, you know, life really is what you make it, isn't it? Even in these worst of times, you can still live a positive existence if you want to.
And it's strange that it's so often seen as the worst of times, because I think if you took anybody and took them back to pretty much any other time in human history, see how they like the fucking work and the, you know, and the...
Let's go to the medieval ages. Yeah.
And fucking the sort of... I mean, that's a lot of what the hope that book is about. It's just like, you know, most of human history is fucking hard, brutal, ugly, downright fucking mean, you know. And it's a testament to our society, the fact that we're so critical of it, even though we've got so much, you know, like
we've never had it so good. Yeah,
never had it so good. But at the same time, I suppose the difference is probably in the whole of human history, there was a strange hope, as if people were moving forwards towards something good, and they had sort of religion and stuff like that in their hearts. Now we've kind of been stripped of some kind of... It's all we're told is that, you know, like there's just a big, you know, ball of fire ahead, basically, and there's not much to look forward to. So we kind of like, we've got everything and we're struggling with a sort of emptiness at the same time, and a kind of, I don't know, like a weird guilt and all that stuff. I mean, as far as the kind of the modern guilt, to me, that feels like people, it's like, I got no time for that, really. It's like, it sounds like another fucking religion, isn't it? You know, it's like beating people up over their, you know, the society is built and we've got our acts in it and do, you know, do what we think is right. But I don't know about constantly feeling like that I've done something wrong, you know, or it feels like an old school religious thing to take on guilt for, I don't know, your circumstances and stuff like that.
And there's also judgment around every corner more than ever, I feel like, as well, which, you know, and part of that is obviously positive, and part of this need and want to highlight the flaws in, you know, a business model or in a government's take on an issue, or, you know, even just within like a human resource element of a company. Like there's a lot of things which can be called to task and improved in the process, but it can also go too far the other way. And like, you know, I think everybody has to want to improve, right? You can't force someone. You can't go, you're a piece of shit, be different now, because all that really does is, I think, breed resentment. And like,
yeah, I mean, you can, I think it's, I without wanting to quote my own songs, but it does feel a little bit like teething problems. I mean, I think the idea of everybody having a platform, it's basically come from the, you know, it's like everybody's got a platform, so it's turned into a bit of a shit show. But I think that, that, you know, like, you can't put the genie back in the bottle, you know, like, we, it's, I feel like people will kind of get used to this, everybody's got a platform, without feeling the need to, yeah, constantly so I kind of belittle or question other people's bits. Well, certainly we need to, don't we? Like I said, I think because if people feel, I don't know, it's like the constant judgment and stuff like that. It's like, it can't be, I mean, I don't feel it. And I constantly put stuff out into the world. And I think that maybe people, if people are sort of worried about,
well, the people are worried are the ones with skeletons, aren't they? Let's be real.
Maybe that's it. Yeah, but then that's kind of going back to the other. That's also, you know, being held accountable is, you know, is something that should fucking happen, isn't it?
Yep.
So it is. It's a fucking minefield, isn't it?
You know? It is.
And
do you know the one thing I don't like is I feel like a lot of the cancel culture trend has popularized bullying, and what I mean by that is, it's very easy now to jump on someone and attack them for something they have or supposedly have done. And I feel like a lot of mean-spirited people who just like bullying people have hopped on board the cancel culture train so they can just basically verbally attack strangers that they don't know and almost like vent whatever the ugliness goes on inside of them. And like, if you're a target of that, it's like you're fair game. Does that make sense?
It does, but I just don't see that if someone's, you know, if someone's messages, I don't see it as necessarily being attacked. It only exists, you know, it's probably the person that's bitching about someone else. In my head, I'd read it into more as the problem's probably theirs, you know, like
the person attacking. That's what I'm saying, yeah.
And yeah, I try not to get too stuck into it or think too much about that world. I think it's kind of like, I think it's actually quite a small...
Well, it only exists online.
Small issue that constantly gets bumped to the top of every conversation, basically.
Like so, right now.
Let's move on.
Well, I want to ask you this. Like, you've always been a spiritual dude, I think, and you've always been engaged in the human experience, and, you know, adventure's always been important to you and connection's always been important to you. And just because selfishly I'm in a place in my life now where I'm kind of making certain changes, I'd love to know how your life changed when you cut out, you know, more of that reckless side of living, because there's definitely like a spiritual aspect to partying, I believe, to a point, but there also comes a time when it does just become kind of a bit destructive, and, you know, the lows outweigh the highs and you're no longer getting these beautiful positive experiences. So when you, obviously, you talk about it in the first book that you did, you cut your last E, as it were, when you look back now, how did things begin to kind of shift and transform and change within your life and your engagement with the world around you when you made that change?
Well, I mean, mine was more physical than it was mental. I actually still think that my head and my heart were actually fine with the amount of sort of hard drugs I was doing. It was my voice was more than anything. You know, it was the
well, which is kind of your signature for a while there wasn't it?
Yeah. It very much was. You know, when I started, you know, I was the guy singing about, you know, smoking fags and doing coke with a voice that proved I'd smoked a lot of fags and done a lot of coke. So it was like, it ticked a lot of boxes, but it got to the point, it was like constantly getting worse. You know, the songs were getting more popular, which was just meant more fags and more coke, more late nights. And then just one day, it was at Glastonbury, my spiritual home. I had this like mental glasto, and I woke up in the morning, I just couldn't talk. And I had this lump in my throat, and that's not me being metaphorical. It was like a physical lump in my throat. I couldn't talk, and you know, I laid there in my little bell tent behind the left field stage, knowing that I wouldn't be able to talk for a few days, and had something of an epiphany where it was just like, I could either keep on smoking and doing coke, or I could sing, basically, and so I just stopped. And within a week of cutting out like pills, coke and fags, within a week, I had another gig the next weekend. And not that anybody else would have heard it, because I was still, you know, gruff as fuck. But like, for me, it was the easiest gig I'd ever played just from 1 week of the fact my voice had come back an insane amount. And I think normally when people have to give up something they're addicted to, you don't normally get much back in return, do you? It's not done that way. But I had this physical thing where I was like, each week my voice got better, you know, over the course of years, you know. And it's just like, and so it was very, very easy, because it was just like, well, it was clear as day, you know, with a physical thing. And I would actually not, this might not be what you want to hear for your spiritual journey.
No, but, I just want to hear your truth.
Well, I mean, I sort of made a point of still kind of attending the gatherings and still being there. And
dude, I just started working at a mate's pub.
Yeah, well, and also
because I still want to be down the boozer, and
right, yeah,
I want to be around that still, just not partaking myself.
Sure, I never gave up drinking. If anything, that probably ramped that up a little bit more, because that wasn't a physical problem. And so I mean, certainly with the, I found, I guess, addictions a little bit like kind of junk food or advertising. You know, the more advertising I see, the less I want to buy. And like the further I was away from the gear, you know, like the less I wanted it, really. And I sort of, when I was in my heyday, I thought that everyone was doing coke all the time, you know. And that was
because
wherever I went, I thought it just appeared. And it turns out that I was actively searching for it. And when I stopped searching for it, it vanished. And I went like, it went, you know, even I remember sort of maybe 2 or 3 years after I'd stopped actually sort of physically laying eyes on a line for the first time, being like, what, how did I go from seeing so many to I was still around in the vicinity, but just from like, so it's definitely switch. I stopped wanting it. And, you know, I have absolutely no inkling, you know, to do it ever again.
That was what I was going to ask. Do you miss it at all? No,
not really. I mean, what's the point? You know, I could sort of like, I struggled to really, I mean, I can sort of think back to some sort of like glorious times on ease, you know, in the sunshine on the roof of a building, sort of having this sort of like feeling of ecstasy, but not with coke. I can't remember back and think, God, yeah, that was really good. It's definitely quite, well, everybody knows what coke is, and it's quite a self-centered drug. It doesn't lead to the same experiences, I think. So no, I wouldn't sort of sit and ponder it again. The switch has been switched. So
you're very much an eyes forward dude, aren't you?
Yeah, exactly.
And I think there's a line in one of your songs I heard today where you're talking about doing a hat trick like 3 nights in a row, and you say something to the effect of like, looking back on that now, it seems insane. And that's the other thing, isn't it? Is like the longer you, and I've only been a few months away from that kind of stuff, but like the longer you are, you look back to certain things which you achieved, if you want to frame it that way, and you think like, that is just berserk. Like that's pure insanity.
That's pretty horrific. That line actually means a hat trick. Actually means meeting 3 different girls on 3 different nights.
Oh, is that what that was? I thought you were talking about 3 big work. It's kind of big
three
nights.
Three big nights. Yeah. Which does seem insane now. What the one night stand heyday. Yeah, God, I feel weird even saying that out loud. But that's what that line meant.
Well, dude, there was, I mean, I almost welled up in a kind of in a different way when I was listening to the Once, is it Once Upon a Time?
Yeah, that is that song. Yeah. It's about the Camden heydays. Yeah.
I mean, that just made me, not just in terms of my life, but it made me think about a time. And I don't know, maybe you could share some thoughts on this. Do you think we will ever go back to a world, and this might seem a little bit like melodramatic or whatever, but after COVID, right, there's obviously been a huge shift in everything. Certain things will come back. Other things I think are gone forever now. Do you think just that world that, you know, you and I came of age in, the freedom of it, do you think that will ever come back? Obviously shows and things will return, but do you think?
Of course it will. I mean, not for me and you, but for teenagers and 20-year-olds, of course. I'm sure that it already exists. You know, like I think the kind of, if you think about the kind of 19, 20-year-olds, they're that, because they don't have this sort of economic value, their story of the last couple of years has been widely ignored, you know, unless you was locked in a university dorm, you know, like chances are you was with your parents and just like no one's telling your story. And, you know, I'm sure they were fucking up to something. You know, like, we just don't know about it because we're old and we're not tapped into it. And like a lot of, when people kept saying, "Oh, you must be really gutted, there's no Glasto this year." And I was like, well, I am, you know, but I've been to Glasto 20 times. You know, it's going to be someone's first ever Glasto. You know, I'd feel more worried for them. But yeah, I think that times like that, of course, well, you know, like youthful sort of hedonism, you know, ain't going to go away because of a 3-year pandemic, 3 years and counting, you know, but that ain't gonna stop, you know, like the beauty of sort of like enjoying music and other people in your 20s.
I hope so, man. Because yeah, I think that so much beautiful art, whether it's music or photography or, you know, drama, theatre, whatever it is, so much good stuff comes from those years, doesn't it? Those key formative, loose, explorative years when you're finding your personality, you're finding your, you know, discovering your worldviews, you're hooking up with people and exploring the world and just getting up to all sorts of mischief. It's a glorious time in one's life, isn't it?
It sure is. Yeah, that song sort of touches on it.
It's a beautiful tune. It's so, dude, are you not doing the cruise this year?
No.
Livid.
Yeah, ask them. After, when you get there, be like, where's Beans? I'm sure everybody
I'll put in
be.
A formal complaint.
Yeah. I mean, I,
is this the first one you've not done? Yeah.
It is.
Is it like a weird subject? Like,
not at all. I mean, in all fairness, I would need to sort out my visa, you know, that my visa run out. I mean, this is boring stuff for a podcast, but I probably could have done and would have done that. But for whatever reason, the call didn't come through. So, but I think hopefully next year.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
I want to ask you about the new book. The first book I absolutely adored. I read cover to cover. I haven't had the time to digest the whole of the second book, but I've dipped into a few chapters. And Frank says it best in the foreword. You know, you've always been a storyteller. Your songs have always been stories. But it's almost seamless how well your style and your voice made that subtle segue. Well, I guess it's not a subtle segue, actually. It's a very, I think, drastic change in format from a song to, you know, the written word. First of all, when you were writing the first book, did you have to, you know, kind of like find your voice? Did it take you a while to find your voice in the written form? Or was it a very easy shift? Because it seems seamless.
Yeah, it was like, it's so different from writing a song. Like when you're sort of writing a song, you kind of start with nothing and you want to create something, which is what I've always loved about songwriting. Whereas like writing the book, the stories in the book, I mean, number one, they happened. Number two, I've been recounting them and retelling them ever since they have happened, you know, like the following week, the following month, the following 4 years. I've been saying them stories, be it on stage or to two people, you know, like for years and years. And that, and I think the telling of them over the years has probably sharpened them up as well. And, you know, they're still true, but it's probably sort of made them a bit more story form. So it was, it wasn't a case of creating anything. It was a case of putting it on paper. I knew exactly what I wanted to say. And it felt a little bit like homework. Like it wasn't that I didn't enjoy it writing it down, but it was just like, I'd have to just be like, because I did it on the first one, I did mostly on a train in Europe. I was traveling alone on the train in Germany. And I was just like, I've got 3 hours every day by myself on my computer. I can't just waste it watching bloody Game of Thrones or something. So I need to, you know, get stuck into it.
Very quickly, this is what I love about you. And this is why I think I massively am just drawn to your body of work and you know, enjoy your approach to everything you do, is that level of productivity just never dips. You know, it's an album every year. It's, oh, I've got a window of time on tour, I'm going to use that and not just zone out. You've always been that way. And I love that about you. We will circle back to that as well and maybe where that comes from. But yeah, so the first one's written on tour on trains.
Yeah. And it was just like, just getting it, you know, it's just like, I didn't tell anyone I was going to write a book. There's one of my favorite songwriters, a guy called Todd Snyder. He wrote a book called I Haven't Met a Story I Didn't Like. Again, just recount a lot of his travel stories and the stories he tells on stage into a book. And I was just like, it's, you know, all right, I just started it. And yeah, it was just like, it just came together really easy. Once I got the most of it done, it was just like, then it was just time. It was just like, right, it's going to take a while to do. And I just need to, the willpower just to sit down and do it. But it wasn't, yeah, it wasn't really like being creative. I mean, obviously I wanted the words to sound nice, but it was like just getting it down. And I think that's why it sounded so, so many people say when they read it, they can hear me, you know, like
telling
talking
it
to them. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And which is, you know, perfect ultimately. And I think that's, I'm not, you know, the truth is I struggle to write a fucking Facebook post without free spelling mistakes and shit like that. You know, it's just like, I just smashed it down and just got other people to spell check it. Just didn't think too much about it. Just got it down. And yeah, you know, was really, really happy with the first one. And it filled, it kind of ticked. It ticked a box. It actually turned out to be a very good business move as well. As much as it was done for creative reasons, it was like when CDs started dropping off, like I do a lot of traveling by myself. I can't fucking carry vinyl and t-shirts and stuff like that around. CDs were always perfect because you could chuck like 30 CDs in your bag, flog them over a weekend. And then when less people want CDs, books are brilliant. They sell really well at merch. You know, you can sign them, you can carry them. They're not precious because the thing is I can't carry vinyl because I'll just fucking drop it, kick it around and stuff like that. Whereas books are quite durable. So they're just like a brilliant touring companion to get my, you know, keep me on the road basically. So it was just, and I think it just sold, like I outsold my records with my books, if you know what I mean. More people, because you couldn't listen to it on Spotify or something like that, you needed the physical product. I mean, there was an audio book, but you needed the physical product. So I just sold a lot more and it was just like really surprised me. And it was like, you know, what a fucking win. And I never thought I'd write another one. I was just like, you know,
well, this is what I wanted to ask you is, I presume you didn't have a second one maybe in mind. So did you just go for gold with the first and almost put like all the best stories in the first? Not that the quality of the stories in the second are any lesser, because they're not, but my publisher gave me a really key piece of advice when I was writing my first book. He was like, basically, he said it in a less crass way than this, but he said, don't blow your load on the first book and try and get everything in there, because you'll want to write more. And if you just cram all the gold in the first one, then where do you go from there?
That's exactly what I did do. I was just like, you know, I was like, it's going to be 10 stories. What are the 10 best?
But it wasn't. Tits.
Yeah. But it wasn't like a long list that I scrubbed some out. And then it was like, oh, these ones are left over. It was, I mean, because the other thing, once I'd written the book, I sort of banned myself from ever telling them stories to people ever again.
Well, that's also smart, because then you can oversat. Because I remember when we did the first chat on the show, I think you were very hesitant then to even recount any of the details of the stories on the show. And I like that, because again, if you want to hear them, they're in the book, but otherwise I'm done telling them.
Yeah, I just imagine the sort of me sort of chatting to a stranger at a gig and sort of like pissed, go off on a ramble thing, and they're like, yeah mate, we've read the book, we know this, you know, like I'm always one for the people that are closest to me listen to me repeating myself all the time, you know, I just say the same shit over and over and just sort of rehash it. So it's like, by getting it in the book, it was like, you know, that's out the window, I can't bring myself to say them anymore. So it kind of drew a bit of a line, which I guess in turn maybe spun up a few others, you know, like that then sort of rose to the new top 10. And there is not wanted to spoil it, there is a kind of like semi-fictional story in there, which I actually kind of was conceived when I was 19, you know, so I sort of went back a bit further.
Do you not want to say which one that is? You want to keep
it's
that?
The open, I mean fuck it, it's the opening Tesco chapter. And what it was like when Dave Danger, who you know, so my best mate, who we grew up together, when he used to work at Tesco. And we used to sit around planning a robbery of the Tesco's that he worked at, you know, just two stoners in a Ford Fiesta in Essex. And we just like, we worked out some pretty nifty ways of how we'd rob it and how we'd escape and stuff like that, get away with all the money. And we even did the sums as to how much money we thought there was going to be there. And we had, you know, it's just, you know, two teenagers fucking shooting the shit. But I'd remembered it all. So I was like, well, I can turn that into a story that we did, and it like turned it into a fictional story that we do actually rob Tesco's, and I start off the book with that, and then say it feels like my first book where it's like me and Dave were smoking weed in a Fiesta, blah 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 blah, and then it's like, and then we fucking rob Tesco's and we fly to LA and all this shit, and then it's like the second chapter says, okay, you know, that was bullshit, but the rest of the stories are true. So there was, you know, I think once I got that one, that idea down for the second book, I was like, That's a great way for it to start. It'll differentiate it a little bit from the last one. And you know, the other stories I think were all worth going in there. And I supposed that I would hope that I learned some stuff from doing the first one. So the second one, sort of like, maybe if the stories were the top 10, the second one stories got a little bit more sort of care and attention into how they were presented. But, you know, they're both sort of performed equally, and you know, in my own little world, they're a success, you know, and like people seem to like them both. And I mean it's weird. I was definitely something that I'm very proud of myself about a book, because like I just never ever would have thought that would be something I would do, you know, write a book and get, you know, and get it out, and I still sort of hold it, and it's like fucking, you know, it's legit, and it's like, wow, nice one.
Yeah, it's a beautiful feeling, man. It's a beautiful feeling. And I think that, you know, it's a testament to just your skill as a storyteller that the book kind of not only has performed well, but it's there, and it's like, it's just an equal window into your soul as any song, I found, from the parts that I've read. And like, there's a brilliant, just as a quick like sidestep, there's an amazing John Waters book. I don't know if you've read this, but it's about, I can't remember the title, but it's I think it's his only book, so it's easy to find. And the format of it is he decides he's going to go on a road trip across America. And basically the first third is like what he wishes and dreamt happened on this journey. So it's all fictional, insane stories of what he would have loved to have occurred. The second part is like nightmarish, horrible visions of everything going wrong. And then the third and final part is what actually happened.
Oh,
and
wow.
And it's a really cool mix. And like, you from where you are now could go into entirely fictionized stories, or you could go into half and half. Like, now you've done that first chapter presented in that way of like grounded in truth, but you know, there's storytelling, fictitious elements. You could now mix that even more with a third book and go off into basically becoming like, you know, a novelist and an author.
Stephen King. I'll do horror.
I mean, dude, you must have been in some horrific situations over the years, but you could. Just from the road stories, man, unbelievable. Have you ever done like, and this might be my ignorance, so sorry if it is, but have you ever done a tour? And I know your shows are half and half, well, not half and half, but there's storytelling elements. But have you ever done a set tour where it is like, here's a story. I did it for the first book.
I did it. I called it the Sitting on a Chair Tour, and seated audiences. And
amazing. How were they?
Sat down. Brilliant. I mean, like, it's strange because what I was doing was very similar, perhaps a bit more chatty, but the feeling of the room, if you sit people down, you know, the same people, the same 200 people could be at a pub and it'd be Larry and it'd be like a normal beans and toast gig, loud, blah, blah. You sit everybody down and it's like, fucking hell. I found it really self-indulgent because I was like, everybody's listening to every word I'm saying, because my gigs are normally quite Larry. And I kept on saying, look, if you need a piss, you just get up and go. I just worry that there's someone going like, oh my God, I'm dying for a piss, or I want a drink. But like, it was lovely. A really nice tour, really fun. And I've done, I did Cheltenham Literary Festival.
You get into some prestigious areas, don't you?
Yeah.
Very cool.
And I'm doing a Cheltenham Literary Festival, which is, you know, sort of pretty highbrow. And they wanted to do this like weird Q&A and stuff. But just before I walked on stage, I was chatting to one of the volunteers about their social media, and they said, I was like, have you not heard? Basically, the year before, they brought on this new social media manager who tried to shorten the name to C Lit Fest. And it's so effectively Clit Fest. Unbelievable. And I was like, and there's like, no one spotted this before you rolled it out as a Twitter handle or a hashtag or whatever. And so that was my kind of running joke of
amazing
of Clit Fest. You know, everybody, I was like, did everybody find it all right? I'm doing Faversham Literary Festival as well. So, and when I get invited to do stuff that is more because of the book, then yeah, I'll do more story-based stuff. Oh, and also did Edinburgh Fringe around the time of the book. And that was, again, seated, and I'd do one or two kind of long stories from the book or from whatever was going on at the time as well.
Did you find you're getting like more creative when you stop partying because you weren't spending half your life hungover? Did you find your creativity levels ramped up?
I mean, I am still partying. It's just not doing.
Yeah, but you're not going for 2 days, are you? Do you know what I mean?
No, I mean, but I don't think like it didn't. Life didn't really change that much for me. You know, like maybe maybe.
You've always just been insanely like productive and creative, then, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose. I guess the truth is that sort of like the world of Beans on Toast started becoming sort of more of a sort of. I started becoming a lot more popular pretty soon after I did give everything up. So maybe, you know, that is because of that. I don't really feel like it is one did the other, but since I've been touring the amount that I have, and you know, like back then it was like two or three festivals a year I was doing, like Glastonbury and maybe one or two others, and now, you know, it's like 20 festivals, you know, a year. So I don't feel like I got more or less creative. I've always, you know, like, it's just life. I don't really see me giving up fags and coke as a big kind of like step or change in my life. It's just, you know, it's something that happened, and everything else was really the same.
So when you started out, and obviously like it was just for fun to begin with, and then, you know, you realize like after a while, I can make a living out of this. This is pretty cool. Now, I mean, your life, correct me if I'm wrong, but it just seems like, you know, knowing you the way that I do and seeing what you do, what a beautiful life you have. You know, you've got a lovely little family, and you just get to like create on your own terms and put out cool stuff that you, you know, love, and your heart and soul is in everything. And it's a business. And like, you know, you can basically pay your way through the world by doing what you love on your own terms. And everybody, I think, who's in a band or like, you know, does something creative for a job is fulfilled to an extent. But a lot of people, it seems, to be able to do it in a way that pays bills, you have to make certain, I don't know whether sacrifices would be the right word, but you know, there's somebody else often calling the shots. Whereas it seems like for me, you're your own boss, and you just get to kind of do your own thing, which is rare and special and awesome.
Yes, I mean, it certainly is. I mean, during obviously the last couple of years being so bad for the sort of music industry, musicians as a whole, the fact that we were, and when I say we, I mean me and my wife, because Lizzie runs all of my kind of merch store and all of that sort of back end stuff she does. But because we were so DIY, we were so equipped for everything that happened. And we didn't have anybody else to let down. It was just, you know, like we just needed to get the fuck on with it.
Yeah.
And but we had all our systems in place. We could sell merch online instantly. We had, you know, we had friends. We were already pals with the Royal Mail delivery office. You know, Lizzie had charmed them with some flowers or whatever, and we could. We had these brilliant systems in place, and we just like I said, it wasn't anybody else relying on us. We just utilized it, and you know, and it worked out for us. In fact, the last chapter in the new book is about how we, you know, bought this house that I'm now sat in now. I mean, we moved out. We got not wanting to spoiler alert, but you know, we got handed our notice in London in after the first lockdown, and at the beginning of lockdown, I wouldn't have been in a place where I could put a deposit down. But some magic happened with selling canvases online. And
well, your style as well, that's another really cool thing about the Beans on Toast brand is, you know, you can see that text, that specific font, and you know right away, like, that's a Beans piece right there.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just, and it's all just sort of like happened over a long time. And I think—
So was that just the little lyric canvases you were doing in lockdown?
Yeah. I sold amazing. A fucking shit ton of them. And it was, I mean, again, I would rather send people to the book to get that full story. But yeah, so we're down in Kent now, and it's, you know, like, so we've got this little studio at the bottom of the garden where all my merch is all stood here, hidden under that box from my daughter's birthday party. But, but yeah, now we got the systems all in place here. And it was that DIY aspect. But I also think it's probably worth saying that, I mean, certainly being your own boss and whatnot, like the only reason that I could really get to this point was, I mean, the work that I was doing when I started off doing Beans on Toast, be it like promoting clubs and putting on shows and sort of managing bands and stuff like that, I always worked within the kind of industry. Basically, yeah, just putting on gigs is probably the easiest way of putting it, and sort of running pubs. But it was like, I was always my own boss in that world anyway. And it was always, I could do, me going out and doing Beans on Toast was kind of like good for the other job. Because I'd go out and find bands and meet bands and be like, hey, I'm putting on shows in Camden.
It all feeds into the same machine, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. And so it also meant that I could say yes to every 70 quid gig or every 50 quid gig or every gig for no money that was offered to me for 4 or 5 years. I did that and, you know, and hammered it out. And then after that, after 5 years of, you know, releasing music and stuff, then it's like, okay, now you can, you know, let go of some other things and this can be a source of income, which is, It's probably an explanation as to why sort of rich people do well in music, if you know what I mean. Because I had a way of making as much music as I wanted and touring and all that, but not needing it to be my a source of income for long enough for it to turn into that, which is why I believe in things like universal basic income. And you know, like I think that if everybody's given, and fair enough, I made that opportunity for myself through the other work I was doing, and you know, just being a jammy motherfucker. But I still think that if everybody's given a chance to concentrate on something that they love, for and to let it turn into something that they can make a living from, well, it just the world would be a better place if everybody could do that, basically. Which doesn't sound to me, I know it sounds like a bit sort of like unrealistic, but I don't see why it should be unrealistic when there's so much money being fucking spaffed up the wall on military and all that shit. I think, you know?
Well, what it sounds, dude, is idealistic, and there's nothing wrong with that, because we could all afford to be a little bit more idealistic, I think, and dream, because it's not like an unattainable, unrealistic dream, what you've just laid out. You know, it's there. It's within your grasp if you want it. And it's pure as well. If you build it up that way, you know, I'm a little bit sooner down the line than you, but I am finally, after all my years of grafting, finally beginning to feel like everything that I've done to date is beginning to manifest in a way that, you know, there's people out there who will now, if I put out a book, they'll support it and buy it and they'll listen to the podcast. And if I do a Q&A tour, they'll maybe come to a show. And if I support a band DJ and they'll come to that. And it's like, and we should say as well, without being cheesy, like, it is the people who support what you do that allow people like me and you to carry on doing it, isn't it?
Oh, of course. You, that's not cheesy. That's just
you and Frank have some of the greatest fans that I've seen. And many, you know, artists will all say, like, we have the best fans. And every fan group, I think, is different because their relationship with that artist is unique, because it's the artist sets the tone, right? And the relationship which the fan and the artist shares is not dictated, because that's the wrong word, but it's set by the person making the stuff. And so every, I think, situation is different, but, you know, you've always had, because you're real, you're you.
One thing that I always makes me happy is when, if I see someone, say at a festival and someone's wearing a bit of Beans on Toast merch, and they always say what a great day they've had because they've met so many new people that come up and be like, yeah. And I was like, that to me, it's like, what an honor that is to be able to just sort of link people up, I guess. Like, so a few people sort of mentioned it, be like, if you wear this t-shirt at a festival, it's going to change your fucking day. You know, like, people will just sort of like come up, which, great. And I guess that's also that sort of being, existing on the level that I do, where it's, you know, like, I don't know whether, as soon as you hit some level of popularity, you know, you're probably not going to go up and talk to everyone. Maybe you would still, you know.
I think you'd maybe get like a nod and a nice t-shirt, like a recognition. Yeah. But what you're saying is a Beans on Toast t-shirt is like a proper conversation starter. And not only
other people have said it, but yeah. But yeah, it makes me happy that it could be. Yeah.
Well, it's good to know that just like the people who are drawn to your music are like cool, not cool, that's the wrong word, fun, decent, you know, positive people.
Well, that feel that they can approach each other just off that sort of like similarity. Like, a really important gig for me. Like, as I said, I worked and went to gigs, you know, like for my whole life, and so much so, be it playing gigs, I wouldn't say they were ever throwaway, but like I was so, at this time, this was years ago, my kind of stage sort of mentality was a little bit like, who gives a fuck? It's just a gig, blah, blah, blah. And I'd sort of walk into gigs and watch my show come out. And then Todd Snyder, who I sort of mentioned the book about earlier, he never played in London. And he announced this show at the Borderline. And I was just like, oh my God, I'd never been so excited. I'd never seen him live. I realized I'd never actually met anybody else that he'd even heard of Todd Snyder. And it's like, and when I went to the gig at the Borderline, I took like my parents and my wife, and I was just like, it was like Jay's big night out. And we got into the Borderline, a venue that I'd been in fucking hundreds of times. I used to run a club night there, you know, and I was like, I'm in a room full of people that like Todd Snyder. And I was like the guy at the bar, like, what's your favorite album, man? Blah, blah, blah. And it was like, it was such an important night for me. And I left being like, fucking hell, that, you know, like, you need to start looking at your gigs differently and other people's, you know, like, these can't be, just because you've done so many of them and been to so many, they can't be a small thing, you know, like, you need to rise up to the fact that it could be special for someone else. And it was a really, really pivotal sort of,
as, like, the performer, you mean, when you step out on stage?
Yeah. And I think I probably started viewing other, maybe shows I was putting on a little bit differently as well, but certainly as a performer, I was just like that, from that experience, I felt like I learned a lot. Yeah.
Let me know, just one off the top of your head, a show that changed your life forever. As in, like, you're the attendee, you're the punter, you go to a gig and it has such a profound effect on you that you are never the same again. afterwards. Hopefully,
well,
in a good
I mean,
way.
That was it. Probably. That was it. That Todd Snyder gig. Yeah. I mean, other shows. I mean, probably my favorite live show ever was Beck at the Royal Albert Hall. And I just moved to London. So I was like 19. And I bumped into this old friend on the tube. And he was just like, mate, do you want a ticket to see Beck? He was a journalist. And I know him from school, but it was really weird. And he was like, do you want a ticket to see Beck? I've only got one. You'd have to go by yourself. I was like, yeah, what the fuck? So I went to the Royal Albert Hall. And because he was a journalist, it was like four rows back from the stage. And Beck was doing this like solo performance where it was just like him, a bunch of old guitars and this old piano. And he just sat on stage and he told really long stories. And, you know, like he spoke a lot about the stories behind the songs and he played all these songs really calm, did like all these blues songs. And yeah, and it was just like me and him because I was four rows. I didn't even look behind me at the whole of the, you know, Royal Albert Hall. And it was just like, I guess that, you know, and that me turning into someone who, you know, is a relaxed on stage and does tell stories and, you know, and is a sort of content solo performer. I guess seeing the Beck one. And also from that Beck gig, he did this like massive explanation about slide guitar and why slide guitar is so beautiful. And then I got on the tube on the way home. I changed at Victoria and there was this guy playing slide guitar, busking at Victoria Tube Station. And everyone that got off the tube had been at the gig and was just like, man, I fucking love slide guitar. And I could see it in this guy's eyes. He's like, what is happening? And it was just like money was just
Twilight Zone moment, like
piling into his case. And I was like, I'm going to fucking tell him. Because Beck was also doing, it was doing two nights. So I was like, I waited for everyone to go. And I just walked up. I was like, do you want me to tell you what just happened? And he was like, please, what happened? And I was like, look, Beck played. He did a half hour speech about slide guitar. All them people cut. And I was like, really, you want to get outside the venue tomorrow? I was like, go to South Kent and you can like busk at that tube station. You'll have five times the amount of people. I was like, I'm sure he'll do the same speech. And he was like, fucking right on, man, I will.
That's a beautiful moment right there, man. And again, as you sort of highlighted with your Todd Snyder story, the power of the show, when you come out of a gig, that kind of, I don't know, the wave of optimism and hope that you feel like, and that feeling that you just can't bottle or recreate any other way other than in this, you know, mass gathering situation where there's a performer, an artist on stage, a storyteller on stage, you have a shared experience and you all leave that thing together like, wow,
yeah,
life's all right, isn't it?
It is. So let me tell you about the tour that I've got coming up as
there
well.
There you go. It's called a segue, yes. That is, people.
Let's get some promo because the it is like, I mean, it is the second half of the Survival of the Friendliest tour. But the musicians that I'm working with, so Jack Flanagan, who from the Mystery Jets, who I made Survival of the Friendliest with, he basically, after we finished the record, he was like, I might be up for some live stuff. And I was sort of looking at piecing a band together for it. I wanted to keep it simple. Anyway, then Kitty from Kitty Daisy and Lewis, Kitty Leave, we're good friends. I made The Inevitable Trainwreck with her in her studio in Kentish Town. And she's just kicking off her solo stuff, basically, outside of Kitty Daisy and Lewis. So I was like, really wanted her to support. And I was like, would you like to support? And do you want to join my band as well? So Kitty and Jack, we're basically like a three piece. Jack Flanagan, Kitty Leave, and myself. We've got this stomp box called The Wozzenator.
Do you create these little lineups for each tour? Because
I feel like
you really do. And it gives each one a different feel, doesn't it? And you also get a different experience each time with this kind of, you know, traveling community
exactly.
feel.
Certainly for the album tour. I mean, I'll generally like to tour the album with some people that I've made it with or do sort of honor the album in, you know, like in a way. And so this setup came about and, I mean, they're both like saying about like still partying. We did 15 shows on the last tour before I got COVID. And
did you get it? Did you? Is that why you had to wrap up yours? Oh, man.
Yeah. I'll tell you about that in a sec. But it's like we did 15 shows. They're both in their like in their mid 20s. And it's like, it's me in my 40s. And they're like, you know, like, it's
they're
like,
ready to go.
It's like, so we did every night, 15 nights. Like, all right, we're going out again. It's like, all right. You know, But it was just both of them amazing musicians. They'd never really met. And then a brilliant girl called Zen doing a merchant driving as well. And it was like three people that had never met that were all great. And we just all just jumped in this van at the time, again, when it was like, you know, Omicron was rising and we was just cutting through it and just playing these. I mean, the Jack and Kitty, both of them, multi-instrumentalists, are just amazingly soulful musicians. And with this stomp, it's just so like just a huge sound. And just me just kind of doing my thing, you know, in front of it with and without the guitar. And again, it's going back to how we started, just sort of like recounting this positive sort of message throughout, and just like, yeah, hopefully giving people, you know, that feeling. And my point is that we leave in 1 month's time to go back. So the first tour in December was the sort of like, for want of a better word, kind of B markets, was in like Stroud and you know, sort of Reading and stuff like that. And this time around, I mean, I should just bloody read them out, shouldn't I?
Do it, mate. I'm going to come and see you on this tour as well, because it's been so long since I've seen you do like a club show.
Yeah, man. Well, we're in Bristol at Lost Horizons, right towards the end.
And amazing. Of February.
End of in March. So it starts in Feb, and we're doing Liverpool, Leicester, Portsmouth, Brighton, Nottingham, Leeds, Sheffield, Stoke, Hull, Edinburgh, Glasgow, Manchester, Newcastle, Norwich, Oxford, Birmingham, Cardiff, Bristol, and London. And some of the venues, I mean, it's basically like a list of my favourite venues in the country. It's like Brudenell Social Club, Gorilla in Manchester, Voodoo Rooms in Edinburgh, Wedgwood Rooms in Portsmouth, Chalk in Brighton, Lost Horizons, which is a new venue in Bristol, and Lafayette in London, which is also Ben Lovett's new venue. So it's like a list of my favourite venues. And yeah, I mean, tickets are selling well, but we could sell some more motherfucking tickets is the truth. So if you're listening, come along, guys, come along.
And never, honestly, I'm not just saying this to be nice, man. I felt it today listening to music. Never has the world needed your voice more. And I think that anybody who listens to this show will, if they don't know your music, will be a fan of you after going and seeing it done live. There's just no way that they couldn't be, because it's a night out and it's an experience. And so few, not so few, but certainly few. There are few people, I think, rather than many, who create moments on a nightly basis. And each night is real and it's raw and it's specific to that town and that place. And you've always been that kind of a performer. You know, you never phone it in. You're never just going through the motions. It's never like a scripted, rehearsed fucking, you know, just like cruise control mode. You're there every night in the moment. And yeah, if anybody has never seen you live and they're listening to this, then I highly recommend going down and checking out the show. Yeah, dude, man. So how was COVID for you then? How was it?
Well, so we started off the tour and it was like, just like I said, as Omicron was rising, and it felt like we were just sort of cutting through the hysteria. I mean, there was nothing COVID safe about the tour at all. You know, we was in small pubs, rammed to the rafters, and I was just like, and the truth is, I was, you know, I was sort of almost taking lead from the crowd a little bit. No one give a shit. You know, I was at the merch stand every night. There was high fives, there was hugs, you know, like,
Contact, baby. Yeah,
it was just, you know, it was what it was. I'd jump off stage every night and sing a couple of songs in the middle of the crowd, you know, like, and I think I actually did that I made a point of doing it every night, because I think it was a little bit like, if you're willing to stand in a crowd, then so am I, kind of vibe. But it just felt like as it got more serious to us in our little bubble doing this every night, it felt kind of like, it was like, oh, it's just hysteria. And then, and also didn't think the lateral flow test worked at all. I was doing one every day and I was like, I'm doing this because I want to do the right thing. But I had pretty much no faith in them things at all. I thought it was just like, what is this strange
science? Fisher Price kits.
Yeah. And it was, and then we was in Stoke. And the more it went on, the more cocky we was getting, kind of in jokes and stuff like that. It was just like, I just thought we'd got that far. Because it's probably also worth saying that I set off on the tour mentally and also financially prepared for the tour not to end, because my Instagram was just like, tour cancelled, show cancelled. So I was just like, we're never going to get through this, you know, like something's going to happen. So I was sort of like half ready for it. And then we was just like, once we was on the road, it was just like, we're going to fucking do this, you know, and we got right off. We was in the hotel in Stoke right opposite the venue, just before soundcheck, probably a little bit late for soundcheck. And I was doing my daily lateral flow. And I said to Jack, who I'd been in sharing a room with for the whole time, she said, while I was doing it, I said, we've got three more lateral flows and we fucking made it. And then I looked down and saw the double lines. And I was just like, I've got COVID. And Jack just grabbed his stuff, ran out of the room. And that was the end of the tour.
What an unceremonious end. And how were you sick or were
and
you
then
all
it
right?
It was just logistics. It was just logistics. How do you get back from fucking Stoke to Kent, you know, without seeing another human? And there's four of us. We've been in the van together. So it's like all this. And I got an Airbnb around the corner from mine here. Just sort of did like, I had enough petrol. And like, I just fucking, I did a PCR test in Stoke and it just hooned it back. And I mean, I was, the first couple, I was like, everyone was like, how you feeling? Do you feel all right? And the truth is, I'd been on the piss for 15 nights, you know, 40 years old. I should have felt awful. But I was all right, man.
You've had worse like, come downs then, have you, than COVID?
I was like, if I feel bad, it's got to be hangover as well. And I was like, sort of mind over matter, like, I'm not going to, you know, like, I'm fine. And I was, yeah, no, you know, no symptoms, just logistics. But I got out of my isolation on Christmas Day so I could come and see my daughter. On Christmas. So it was, you know, like it was what it was. We missed out three shows. All them three shows have been rescheduled into the other tour. I mean, I obviously don't know the science behind it, but I believe that I'm immune.
Yeah, there you go. I haven't had it yet, touch wood. I haven't had it. And
So a bit of natural immunity that covers the next tour is all good for me.
Well, this one, without jinxing it, because I won't, I'll touch wood again. This is basically in the can, isn't it? This next one.
Happy days.
Well, dude, listen, if I don't get to make Bristol because of whatever reason, I'll come to Birmingham. I will come I'll come to one of the two, and it's going to be great to see you. And what's next for you? Just another album later in the year, as always, as standard?
Yeah, man. I'm actually working. It is going to be a different one.
Tell us or not?
No, but it's definitely different. It's a huge mix up from what I normally do, my next album.
Wow. Well, just keep on doing what you do, man, because I love it and everybody else does. And what's it now? 14 albums in? How many have you done?
Yeah, 14. Yeah, because it was two last year. So, yeah, the Survivor of the Friendliest was album 14.
So this one.
But there's plenty more
next,
where that come from.
Oh, of course
That'd be 15.
Although you're never going to stop, are you? Until like something
drastic
happens.
As long as I'm allowed to. As long as I'm, I'll definitely do it for as long as, you know, like I'll just keep
forever.
Forever. Yeah. Forever and ever. Amen.
Pleasure seeing you, mate.
Mate, thanks so much, Matt. Always a pleasure.
And I'll see you on the road.
Mwah.
Cheers, dude.
Get down if you're up for it, or if you're sick and tired of all of it. Maybe riddled with anxiety, but still excited about what you're having for tea. And for the sake of tomorrow, let's do it today. Okay, because the world has always been wild and unpredictable. That's half the fun of it. Nobody has got a clue, but not everybody thinks we're doomed. Not everybody thinks we're doomed. Because the world has always been wild and unpredictable. That's half the fun of it. Nobody has got a clue, but not everybody thinks we're doomed.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight. and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.